This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. William Styron, the author of such classics as Sophie's Choice and The Confessions of Nat Turner, died of pneumonia Wednesday on Martha's Vineyard. He was 81. William Styron's first novel, published in 1951, was Lie Down in Darkness, a story about madness and alcoholism in a southern middle-class family. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1968 for his historical novel, The Confessions of Nat Turner, about the leader of a slave rebellion. Sophie's Choice, about the psychological after-effects of surviving the Holocaust, won a 1980 American Book Award and was adapted into a film starring Meryl Streep. As it happened, William Styron was not immune to the psychological pressures and suicidal depressions he so often wrote about in his fiction. In 1985, when Styron turned 60, he was overcome by a depression so unrelenting he nearly took his life. After months of that painful disorder, he checked into a hospital. 7 weeks later, the fog began to lift. Styron began performing lectures about his struggle with depression, and in 1993 wrote a book about his experience. It was called Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. After that, Styron collected a trio of stories previously published in Esquire magazine, stories connected by an obsession with mortality. The collection, called A Tidewater Morning, Three Tales from Youth, was published in 1993. Since then, though, Styron continued to fight depression and was hospitalized several more times before his death this week. Terry spoke with William Styron in 1990, when Darkness Visible, his account of his depression, was first published. Their conversation begins with him reading a passage from that book.
In virtually any other serious sickness, a patient who felt similar devastation would be lying flat in bed, possibly sedated and hooked up to the tubes and wires of life support systems, but at the very least in a posture of repose and in an isolated setting. His invalidism would be necessary, unquestioned, and honorably attained. However, the sufferer from depression has no such option, and therefore finds himself like a walking casualty of war, thrust into the most intolerable social and family situations. There he must, despite the anguish devouring his brain, present a face approximating the one that is associated with ordinary events and companionship. He must try to utter small talk and be responsive to questions and knowingly nod and frown and, God help him, even smile. But it is a fierce trial attempting to speak a few simple words.
I think a lot of people are empiricists when it comes to disease. If you don't have a fever or if there isn't a limb falling off,
right,
you go about your business.
Right.
You don't like using the word depression. You don't think it really gets across how this state of mind really feels.
Yeah, I wish there were another word, but there isn't. So I do use it, but sort of with a sense that it's inadequate, really.
Can we talk about what that state of mind feels like, what your symptoms were?
Well, the thing I've tried to insist in a mild way throughout whenever I've written about the illness is that it's virtually indescribable. It doesn't resemble it's pain, but it's pain that is, as William James said, is totally unknown to normal experience. It's a pain that normal people have never felt, that is, people who live in a normal frame of health, a frame of mind. I think the closest I've ever been able to hit upon an analogous pain is that of suffocation, or of being imprisoned in an intensely hot room from which there's no escape. It's that kind of sort of diabolical discomfort that it resembles more than anything.
You went through a long period of dreamless sleep. When did you start realizing that you weren't dreaming anymore?
Well, very early on in the course of the depression, I realized that something odd had happened, that along with the intense insomnia that accompanies this illness, there was indeed a dreamlessness, an absence of what I guess the experts would call an REM sleep, which is that rapid eye movement sleep that attends dreaming. And I didn't have any. It disappeared.
You write that exhaustion combined with sleeplessness is a rare torture. What would you do when you were lying awake at night, knowing that it was very unlikely that you'd ever really fall asleep?
Well, that's when you really begin to brood in the most profound way upon the meaninglessness of this illness, which really becomes a kind of point of departure for thinking about maybe a life is not really worth living. If this kind of torture, if indeed daily experience becomes a form of torture, and if in addition to that, the torture appears to be something that's going to have no termination, then what point is a life? That's when people begin, I think, in this very common moment of experience to think about suicide.
Let me ask you, this may sound like a really dumb question, but how different was this period of depression from ordinary life for you? I mean, were you like very moody and often depressed before this illness set in?
No, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things. I'd always prided myself, and I'll always have, being somewhat of a amateur expert in medical matters. But a depression and its manifestations were something totally alien to me. I don't know, but whether I might have consciously or subconsciously repressed the very idea of learning anything about depression. At any rate, until this thing happened to me, I was an ignoramus about a depressive illness. And therefore, although I may remember retrospectively moods of low moods, I never once before this thing happened to me, as far as I can tell, ever had a serious depressive episode. It was an alien experience to me.
Writer William Styron is my guest. Were you able to write during your depression?
No. During a serious depression, the intellectual faculties are really exterminated. They don't exist. The power of concentration. One ultimately is I found that I was unable really to read a newspaper or even look at television, even look at a news program. At that moment, ultimately, not only is the concentration erased, the power of concentration, but the pain that is coexisting with the rest of one's bodily functions is so intense that it's a matter of total distractedness. You can't really concentrate on anything. It's akin to having an overwhelming pain which completely dominates one's mind and one's experience.
What do you think brought on this depression?
Well, in my own case, as I said in the book, I for the first time in my life, I was unable to drink. I suffered an intolerance to alcohol very, very suddenly, in a matter of days. It was as if something had occurred in my metabolism to cause alcohol to cause me to be nauseated and repulsed by alcohol. And so I had to stop drinking. It was as simple as that. And I think the withdrawal from alcohol, the sudden withdrawal of a substance I had been abusing for so many years, allowed the anxieties which that very alcohol had stifled to come down upon me and to take possession of me.
You were also taking tranquilizers to sleep at night, and you think that might have contributed too?
Definitely. I had taken for as a result of a foolish doctor whom I'd asked to help me over a rather temporary bout of insomnia. I'd asked this doctor to give me a prescription for something. He gave me something called Ativan. And Ativan is a minor tranquilizer, which is also, if you take it long enough, quite addictive. And as a matter of fact, I shouldn't have been taking it for more than a couple of weeks, and I had taken it for 2 years. I think one of the reasons that this depression was exaggerated was the moment when I went off Ativan without any realization that to do so could have was really a very dangerous thing, which potentiated the depression.
Then you ended up taking something else.
And then I began to take Halcyon, which is another doctor prescribed. And Halcyon at that time was, although it was not known then to be a dangerous pill, has been demonstrated to be extremely dangerous in that certain susceptible individuals, such as myself, can really get all the suicidal symptoms that depression itself offers. And I had that. It was toward the end of this depression, or toward the, I should say, the weeks before I went into the hospital, I was taking a much more hefty dose of Halcyon than I should have, and I'm convinced that that exaggerated the symptoms.
Your parents were depressive too, weren't they?
Well, my father was. My mother, I don't think, was. My father definitely had suffered from this illness in a very serious way, and I have no doubt that that was a contributory factor, certainly.
William Styron speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1990 interview with William Styron. The author of Sophie's Choice and The Confessions of Nat Turner died of pneumonia this week. He was 81.
Looking back at your previous books, do you think that there's a sense of your depression, which came later, reflected in your earlier books?
Oh, absolutely. As I said in the book, my book, Darkness Visible, after I recovered from this depression, I was amazed to see how accurately I had, in this, out of my own probable subconscious, created the mood of depression fictionally in the minds of these various characters that I had created, Peyton Loftus and Sophie and her lover Nathan. They were all depressive people, all suicidal. All of this came from somewhere, and I suspect they came out of my subconscious.
As it turns out, you had several friends who were also depressives, some of whom were actually suicidal. Did it help or hurt to talk to those friends, especially if they were in a similar depressed state?
Well, I think it's invaluable to talk to people who are your fellow sufferers or who have experienced this illness. I think it can't be emphasized enough that people who get well and recover from this illness often do so through the moral support of others, people who keep telling them that they're going to get well, because most people do indeed get well. But it requires a great deal of patience and a great deal of fellowship on the part of others to help one through.
Did hearing that you were going to get well, did hearing that from fellow sufferers have a lot more meaning than hearing it from people who were, you know, high-spirited and would tell you, hey, things will be fine, just hang in there?
Yes. The best example is my friend Art Buchwald, the columnist, who is one of my closest friends. And he had gone through this illness very seriously just a few months before I had. And when he was coming out of his, I was going in mine. And it was his support. He was on the phone to me from Washington to Connecticut virtually every day for weeks. I was reporting in. He would say, how are you doing? One day I'd say, a little bit better, I think. Or the next day, I'm down. And he was always there with these words of support and saying, look, you're going to get well, and you should, don't give up. If you have to go to the hospital, go. And this was very important to me.
Can you describe the point at which you realized that you were getting suicidal?
Well, it was a long, progressive situation. Once this illness takes hold in its extreme, as I said before, when the pain becomes so constant and enduring, you say, is life worth living? And then I don't think you can, at least I can't describe the exact moment when I said, I could take my life, but I do recall that the sense of the futility and hopelessness and the pain was all so great that not a day went by when I did not actively contemplate ways to end my life.
There was one time, as you describe in your memoir, when you came really close to suicide, but you found you couldn't possibly draft a suicide note. Did you have this literary self-consciousness about it? Like, well, what if they printed it in the newspaper? I'd have to really use like all the right words here and make it worthy of my career as a writer.
Well, I think that was, to be quite honest, that may have been a component of my inability to finally get it down. But basically, it was the total futility of trying to adequately express anything about this prodigious act that one is contemplating. You begin to say to think to yourself, well, I want to say farewell to so and so, and then it's like a guest list at a party. You don't know. You're wondering who you left out. So it all becomes a kind of a semi-comical activity, and ultimately, at least in my case, quite impossible. I just gave up the attempt.
Things eventually got so bad you decided to just check yourself into a hospital. What did you expect to get from a hospital that you couldn't get at home?
Well, I think what one finally seeks for in the hospital is safety. Seclusion. After all, in a house, and let's be blunt about it, you're able to at least find the means to destroy yourself. And this, ultimately, in major depression, is a total preoccupation. In a hospital, this is no longer possible, except in you know, sort of bizarre instances. Good hospitals are so constituted that, among other things, suicide is made an impossibility. That's the major reason. And indeed, when I was in the hospital, I found that the sense of security was so great, ultimately, that I lost these suicidal ideas. They disappeared.
To what do you attribute your recovery?
I think important to the recovery was the, among other things, but I want to be blunt about this too. I consider the withdrawal from Halcyon or the cessation of Halcyon as being an important factor, but. I would not attribute my depression entirely to this pill at all. I was headed for a downward slide without Halcyon. I do think that ultimately my recovery was because in the hospital I found a kind of seclusion, a kind of ability to feel safe, and a sequestration, a place where I really withdrawn from the chaos of normal life, I found peace.
How do you think being depressed and then getting through it has affected your writing?
Certainly, it has not affected it negatively. I think I'm not sure whether the experience of depression leaves you a better person. I very much doubt it. I think you're very much the same person you were. But you have been there. You've experienced something that of dreadful compass, you could say, something that you've been in a strange country, and to come back from that country and to be able to reflect on it and write about it is in itself a rather chastening and also an enlightening experience, self-enlightening, because it's a place you never expected to be, and it's a horrible place, and to come back and be able to deal with it is very cathartic.
William Styron, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Styron speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness, his account of his battle with depression, was published that year. The author died this week at age 81.